when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, Law and Order. A former prosecutor and a defense lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. Listeners are advised that this episode contains descriptions of murder and intimate partner homicide. Discretion is advised.
Well, hi, Joe.
Hello, Lizzie.
Welcome back to us.
Thank you to the podcast. It's great to be here.
Now, today, I think you are going to talk to us about some poisoning cases that one, I think, has been in the media recently, but there have been others of note.
Yes. So poisoning cases, I think people have a sort of a fascination with. You know, there's that movie with Jeremy Irons and Glenn Close about the Klaus von Bülow in America in the 80s, where he was said to, or maybe late 70s, said to have injected his wife with a fatal dose of insulin. And that was then made into a movie.
Not familiar with that one. It might be your generation's.
My movie references are all pretty old. The case that's in the media at the moment is Erin Patterson. She has been charged with 3 counts of murder and 4 counts of attempted murder in relation to poisoning. And I'll go into some details about that in a minute. But what I found interesting about it is talking to some of my friends about it, because it's been in the media. I've been struck by the way everybody is talking as if she is guilty. And the matter hasn't gone to trial yet. But one of the things that, I mean, I think lawyers know is that poisoning cases can be notoriously difficult. And there are, you know, two miscarriage of justice cases that I'm going to talk about, both of them poisoning cases. One, a very famous English case, old English case, but one of them is an Australian case from the 1970s, early 80s in relation to poisoning. And I think those cases really highlight some of the problems that you can have in poisoning cases.
But coming back to the fact that the media are talking about this and maybe with the slant that she is guilty, I mean, that's not unusual.
No, I mean, we talked about it in our episode on media and the law. Absolutely. I think that the way the media are slanting their stories are that she's guilty. And so one of the couple of things I wanted to do is point out, you know, some potential weaknesses in the case. I mean, we don't know. The matter hasn't gone to trial and we have to presume that she's innocent. But I object to some of the reporting because I think that it's putting a certain gloss on the case. And there's other things that they're not saying, which hopefully I'll say, which people might want to consider.
I think that is fairly standard, though. I mean, the media saturates every type of internet platform we have, and people are entitled, even in the media, or especially in the media, to have opinion pieces.
Mm.
And that's meant to be a separate sort of consideration to evidence in court, which can be the only thing that leads to a conviction or an acquittal. So I don't see
I'm all for opinions. I just think pretrial publicity can be I think, you know, we need to be a bit more careful about pretrial publicity before somebody has been tried. Afterwards, sure. But, I mean, before they've chosen a jury and people are trying to be objective and listen to the evidence as opposed to what they've read in the newspaper.
Or we could go down that rabbit hole. Maybe we will a bit later.
Yeah, yes. Starting from first principles, so we've talked about before on the podcast the elements of murder. So it's the causing the death of a person and doing it with that intention to kill or do serious harm. So in a poisoning case, I think that breaks down into there's a sort of some potential problem areas in terms of proving those. So I think first problem that you sometimes see in a poisoning case is establishing the cause of death, working out that somebody has been poisoned, because what tends to happen is that they fall ill and then they die and then there has to be an autopsy to work out what exactly killed them. And I mean, I'm not a medical scientist, but I understand that determining poisons and how people die can often be very problematic. I've done a number of cases where cause of death has been an issue, not poisoning cases, but, you know, the TV, I think, and TV show CSI makes it out like doctors can just identify very quickly how people died. The reality is, in my experience certainly, that depending on the type, on the cause, on the way the person died, it can be quite difficult determining how people died. And I think poisoning is one of those kind of cases.
Why? If there's some substance, some toxic substance detected, why would it be so difficult to track that back?
Well, I think probably a number, again, we're getting onto some science stuff, but let me just have a bit of a stab at it. One, I think you've got to know what toxic substance you're looking for. I think the idea that there's some general test that'll just tell you what substances, you know, can be, you know, that you, if you know what you're looking for, you could be right. And there's certainly a case where they knew what they were looking for and found it. But also, you know, the way that poisons kill people in terms of their actual method of death, you know, does the heart stop, or, you know, does the all the organs fail, or, you know, I think that you've got to, if you can determine exactly what caused the, you know, what exactly in the body stopped working, and that can then help you determine what the poison is. Because it seems to me that, as I say, if you know what you're looking for, you're okay. But if you don't know what you're looking for, can be problematic. And I don't think that was a particular problem in the Aaron Patterson case, but I think it what they're looking for was a problem in some other cases.
So maybe where someone has died, but there might have been other medical issues, like.
That's right. I mean, if they've got, you know, if they've got some other medical issues, is it because of that that the death was caused? Or
right.
So once you've determined, okay, so the person was definitely died from this poison, the next thing you've got to work out is how that poison was administered or got into their system, ingested, and what link does the accused play in that? Because as we'll see in some of the cases, some of these people were voluntarily taking certain things that ended up killing them.
Knowing that they were toxic?
Yeah, well, one of them was arsenic in the 19th century. Arsenic was taken in small doses as a form of medicine. But arsenic can build up in your system to the extent that it gets to a lethal level and then you die. Mm. And that's the Florence Maybrick case, which we'll look at later. He was voluntarily taking arsenic. And then he dies of arsenic poisoning and she's charged with his death. So exactly how the poison gets into their system and how that relates to the accused, I think, can be problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume you establish that. Then it needs to be established that there is this intention to kill or do serious injury. And I think that's in the Aaron Patterson case. I'll go through in a second. But I think that's where it's problematic.
Putting aside our 19th century arsenic example.
Cases. Yes.
If you are deemed to have administered a toxic substance that has caused death, how hard could it be to show that that was deliberately done? Like,
well, if we look at the Klaus von Bülow case very briefly, he's injecting his wife with insulin. He used to inject her. She was a diabetic. He would inject her regularly. They said that he injects her with a sort of a dose of insulin that sends her into a coma. That's then proved to be false. But I mean, if he is injecting her with medication as part of her medical care, you know, and then it comes down to, well, what's the dosage and how much was it accident, you know. So the way that it's administered and the reasons for it being administered, I think, can often be problematic in a poison case.
But if it wasn't like medicine, but it was a poison, it would be less difficult, wouldn't it, to establish that intention?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, if you, you know, force a cyanide capsule down someone's mouth and they eat it and die pretty instantly, yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be an easy poisoning case to establish.
All right.
But in terms of establishing that intention,
yes,
why else would you be pushing
that's
a cyanide capsule down someone else's throat except to cause death or grievous bodily harm, or, sorry, serious injury? But anyway, so I think that there are these three potential problems that can come up. Not all three of them in every poisoning case, but they're things that I think that have got to be looked at. Mm-hmm. So if I'll go through the Erin Patterson case. She is 48 years old. She's a stay-at-home mum. She has two children. She lives in a little town in Gippsland, Victoria, which is a beautiful country area of Victoria. It's called Leongatha. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Leongatha. So she has a troubling relationship with her ex-husband, and they have arguments over access to children. I understand. I'm getting all of this from the newspapers.
Okay.
A lunch is organised to, according to the newspapers, discuss the ongoing issues with access to children. Between her and the ex. And the people who are invited to the lunch are her ex-husband, his parents, so her former parents-in-law, and his auntie and uncle, so her sort of
it's interesting.
In-law, auntie and uncle-in-law. So it's five people who were invited. Now, at the last minute, and I don't know exactly how long before that is, but at the last minute, the paper records, the ex-husband pulls out of the lunch.
So it's just his family going?
Just his family going and her, and they have this lunch. Now, at the lunch, Erin Patterson serves beef Wellington, which she has prepared herself. I will come back to beef Wellington later. And after the lunch, all four of the guests get sick, seriously ill, and are all hospitalised. Three of them die.
Wow.
So her former parents-in-law, so her husband's parents, and her husband's auntie, her former auntie-in-law, all pass away.
Wow.
The uncle
in
survived.
In a short time frame.
Oh, no, they. I think they were lingering in hospital for a couple of weeks.
Gosh.
So there's an investigation into the matter, and she is...
Did they originally suspect murder, or were they just doing an investigation as to the cause of death?
I think they were doing an investigation as to cause of death. So that happens, the lunch is in July. She's not charged until November, and I'm going to talk about that too, that period of time and what the police did or might have been doing in that time to try and build a case.
And obviously she didn't get sick.
She did not get sick. I don't know whether she ate it or I haven't seen anything about it. She doesn't get sick, but they do.
Okay.
Now, so the medical evidence comes back and it says that the death was caused by what are called death cap mushrooms. I don't know anything about mushrooms and I'm not a particularly good cook. So
you probably wouldn't eat those.
I suspect
ones.
If something's labelled death cap mushrooms, you're not thinking I'm going to make a risotto. Yes, no. I don't know. So that's determined, but then it's not for a while that she's charged. She's interviewed, a long interview by police in August. In that interview, she talks about the mushrooms. Now, I assumed when I started reading the story, she's somebody who likes collecting fresh produce, has picked the wrong mushrooms, you know, and put them in this. Now, I don't know about you, but...
Like, my mind immediately went to, that must have been deliberate.
Magic mushrooms. I mean, I don't know what your parents were like. When I was young, my parents were very much like, they're good mushrooms, they're bad mushrooms. I can't remember which is the difference. I just avoided all mushrooms.
Yes.
But, you know, we were certainly told that if you ever see these ones growing, they're the bad ones. And
I think we were just told any wild growing ones, do not eat.
Do not eat, yeah. So you just buy store-bought ones. Mm. And apparently in Leongatha, wild mushrooms is a thing to the extent that the hotel sold a fettuccine, I think it was, a wild mushroom fettuccine. Ah. So I don't know whether they grow in the area or something.
Patrons be warned.
Well, obviously after this, they took it off the menu. Mm. So, but it turns out that we learn from the media who find out from the statement that Erin Patterson gave to the police. I don't know how the media got that statement or this portion of it, but that she bought mushrooms from a Chinese grocery store. So these aren't mushrooms that she has sourced herself. She's gone and bought them from a grocery store. Now, I think that, you know, is interesting in that, you know, I guess that they're not selling death cap mushrooms.
Like, was that confirmed that she had bought mushrooms?
Well, we haven't had the trial. So this is what she's told the police. Okay. I don't know what, you know, truth or otherwise of that. I'm putting it out
there. I wonder what impact that had on the Chinese store.
Yeah, I wonder if she named them. Maybe not. Mm. But as I say, I'm sure they're not selling death cap mushrooms.
No, I know, but it would have an impact anyway. But
they then continue to investigate. Now, the police bring in what are called, I think they're called technology dogs or something. I heard they were bringing in sniffer dogs to the house. I thought, well, that's interesting. Presumably they're looking for mushrooms. No, it turns out they were looking for technology. They were looking for hard drives, computers, data keys, mobile phones.
It's incredible what those dogs can do.
I know. So these dogs specifically smell out these things, and I don't know what they found or what they were looking for, but I'm going to take a stab and say they were looking for evidence that Aaron Patterson had been going onto Google, Googling death cap mushrooms or how to kill your husband or something.
Right. It's amazing how many people do stupid things like that.
Yeah, Google.
Remember
Baden Clay.
Yeah.
That's right.
His Google searches got him in a lot of trouble before he killed his wife.
Well, I think standard police procedure in investigating certain crimes is to go straight to your Google search history. I'm interested to know what they found. Certainly, I haven't seen any paper reporting what they found. My guess is they found nothing.
Why?
Well, because otherwise we would have heard about it. I mean, stuff that seems to be a bit incriminative does seem to be making its way to the newspapers. So I think it would be unlikely the police would keep, if they found some smoking gun, that would, I mean, for example, in the Baden Clay case, the fact that what he'd been Googling was in the papers well before the trial.
Everybody and actually, should we just give context? So yes. Jared Baden Clay, a man from Brisbane who has been convicted of murdering his wife, Alison, and part of the investigation revealed that he had Googled life insurance policies.
Yeah, I think it was, yes.
He had Googled your right to silence.
Right to silence, that's right.
Something else. And also technology got him because he said he'd been asleep the whole night she went missing.
Mm.
And then they could track that his iPhone had been out and about and put back on charge at 1 a.m. or something. So,
yes,
lots of technology-based evidence.
And a very high-profile case. I think they were a reasonably wealthy couple in a well-to-do suburb. She was missing for a few days.
And he'd made public appeals.
Yes.
It was a really tough one.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the technology dogs have gone in. Now, they don't arrest Aaron Patterson until November. So what are the police waiting for? I'm going to have a guess here.
Sorry, can I just ask?
Yes.
Did you say that they knew the mushrooms had been eaten in the Beef Wellington at this point?
That seems to be what is the mushrooms are in the Beef Wellington. I think Aaron Patterson has admitted using mushrooms are an ingredient in Beef Wellington. I should say that.
Okay.
I'll come back to that. And she's admitted to cooking the Beef Wellington, putting these mushrooms that she bought from the Chinese grocer in the Beef Wellington.
Okay.
Serving it up.
And other question.
Yes.
When she was charged.
Mm.
Like, is she on bail or is she on remand?
Ooh, I don't know that.
Okay. Because I wonder if some of the information was made available through the bail application, if there was one.
Yes. That's possible. So to explain, when a person is, when the police are, when there's a bail application, affidavits are filed in the court, and those affidavits are often public, so you can go to the registry and search them, and so that in cases, criminal cases, often the media can get information from affidavits filed by police.
Because I think that happened with Baden Clay.
Mm.
Yeah.
So there was a case of Susan Neil Fraser in Tasmania, not a poisoning case. She was convicted of killing her husband. He went missing. He's never been found.
Is this the boat one?
Boat one, yes. Mm. He was staying overnight on a boat, never seen again. Some blood found on the boat. Anyway, she was convicted, but there was a lag period between him going missing and being presumed dead and her being arrested. And during that time, the police bugged her house because they wanted presumably her to be walking around talking to herself about how she had murdered her husband. Now, they, besides bugging her phone and her house, they got nothing for that entire period. Zero for the entire period.
You're so cynical.
Well, what else are you, you know, she lived alone. I mean, what else are you expecting? I don't know. So, you know, I mean, it's like Lady Macbeth walking the ramparts out damn spot, you know, whatever. So anyway, they don't get in there yet.
I think that's fine for the police to be utilizing investigative techniques, particularly like you're coming at it probably from defense.
Yeah, of course I'm coming at it
from defense. But if it was your relative who was missing, you'd be like, yes, bug the house. Let's see what we can find.
I don't have any problems with that. These search warrants are highly regulated. Those kind of covert warrants have to go before in Queensland a Supreme Court judge, I presume the same in Tasmania, and they have to satisfy certain thresholds. And they wouldn't be issued if that wasn't satisfied. I have no problems with that. The issues I have is that it doesn't, you know, they don't seem to take into account their investigative techniques that find nothing. They only take into account things that find something. But the fact that they do all of this stuff and they don't find that she's on the phone talking to people about how she just murdered her husband, they don't find anything incriminating, that's relevant for the jury to know. And that isn't something the defense should bring out. That's something the prosecution should bring out.
But if they don't utilize all of their investigative techniques, you don't know what evidence they would miss. And so you can't fault them for trying to get to the truth. And if nothing comes of one particular technique, that's not on the police. That's not them doing something wrong. And it's like you wouldn't expect police to say, oh, we searched the park where she'd gone and found nothing. Like the evidence that comes out in court is what they have found. That's...
Well, I must say, I think that it should be. It depends on the circumstances. Police often do an enormous amount of searches and investigation. I don't think they have to go through a chapter and verse. But, I mean, I think that was very relevant in that case that they do all this covert searching and it doesn't come out. I mean, in the Mallard case, Andrew Mallard from West Australia, we've talked about before, he's convicted of murdering a woman in a shop. And they did an enormous amount of covert work on Mallard. They put a covert operative to befriend him and follow him for a number of days and got nothing. Now, none of that came out at trial. That was all discovered later on and put in the pardon petition. So I think there are occasions when investigative techniques that turn up nothing do need to be put before a jury, because I think that's useful. Now, I don't know what they found, if anything, in this period of time between, you know, August when they interview Erin Patterson and then arresting her in November. But my guess is that they have done the same thing, that they have put bugs in her house, they've tapped her phone, and they've tried to get some evidence that way. And again, my guess, I don't know, is that they haven't found anything, because if they had, I suspect it would have been leaked to the media.
All right.
All right. So... the problem in the case seems to be, I talked about the three problems that you can potentially have in a poisoning case. I don't think it's a problem, the cause of death. I think the medical evidence seems to be clear. This is what they died from. And then the administering of it, how the accused is involved in administering the poison, in this case, again, doesn't seem to be an issue because it was at the lunch. They all ate it and she prepared it.
Except her.
Well, I don't. Maybe she's immune to it. Who knows? But, it's the third one, this intention to kill or do serious harm, that I think is problematic in this case. Okay, so serving a lunch to somebody that then causes them to get severe food poisoning, even life-threatening food poisoning, you know, doesn't indicate an intention to kill or do serious harm, unless you've put something in it. Unless you have put, like one of the other cases we might talk about, antifreeze in it.
Good God.
So, I mean, antifreeze is never going to be an ingredient in anything that you're cooking. But if it's mushroom, I mean, if it's death cap mushrooms, okay. You know, nobody's eating death cap mushrooms. But if they are, you know, in a packet of mushrooms and you don't know, or, you know, you go and pick them in the woods thinking that they're not death cap mushrooms, but they are, I mean, those two circumstances don't indicate an intention to kill or do serious harm.
So I guess my pause for concern here is she didn't get sick, which seems either extraordinarily lucky or by design.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I mean, we're not talking about her current family. This is her ex's family. Presumably, it was not all, you know, sunshine and lollipops between them. So that adds a layer of consideration that perhaps there was motive. And I know that motive is not the same as intention. We have to be very clear to distinguish those two things at law. But evidence of motive can contribute to evidence leading to intention. So that's where I would be thinking, don't rush too quickly to say inadvertent poisoning.
So I'm not, I'm just postulating a few possibilities that I haven't seen reported in the media because nobody knows, it hasn't got a trial. But I think that, you know, giving other possibilities that aren't being reported in the media, I think, you know, is useful because I, as a defense lawyer, read this stuff and I think, well, hang on, you've missed out this bit or what about that bit?
Okay.
But I think you do raise interesting points. So this idea that obviously there might be no love lost between her and her former in-laws is an interesting one. Now, I'm sure we all know people or have been in situations where we've had ex-in-laws that we have problematic relationships with, or we know people who have. I think the fact that they were prepared to come over, this wasn't sort of an intervention where they just sort of came over unannounced, sat around and had some, you know, browbeating discussion about access to kids. This was a pre-planned sit-down meal. That sounds quite convivial. That says to me that there's a level of goodwill in the relationships that they were prepared, and a level of civility that they were prepared to do that.
Well,
so,
but then I come back to the fact the actual ex dipped out at the last minute, which, again, is either extraordinarily lucky or coincidental. I don't know, like what?
I don't know. I haven't seen media reports about
that. How did he get
on
with his parents?
Well, I don't. Well, sorry, he's the victim of three of the attempted murder charges. So,
oh, okay.
So she, yeah. So it's three murder charges for the three people who died after the lunch. Four attempted murder charges. One for the person at the lunch who survived.
Yes.
And then three for earlier occasions where her husband, ex-husband, had eaten her meals and become ill.
Oh, a slow learner.
Is it? Let's think about that. But anyway, if you say, well, she just hates her in-laws so much. Well, I mean, maybe, but certainly the level of civility that she was showing or that they were evincing doesn't evidence that.
Mm.
Then, you know, there's this idea that, okay, so you hate your ex and they say he wants to kill the ex. So he's the man who, she's angry at, she wants to kill him, hence the attempted murder charges. If she wants to kill him, when he doesn't come to the lunch and she's poisoned the beef, why does she serve it? Why doesn't she go, oh, that's spoiled, we're just going to have to get takeout?
Getting takeout, but if you've invited people over for lunch and you've prepared something, you're not going to have a second meal ready to go.
No, sure, but I mean, at the risk of killing people, you reckon you just go, oh, sorry, everybody, you must have, I've been at lunches where things aren't cooked properly and you're like, oh, should we serve that? Oh, you know, obviously they're not death cap mushrooms, but
thank the Lord.
You know, things take longer to cook than you want. People are sitting around and you're like, oh, what do we serve?
But if we're talking about someone, and I know that these are only allegations at this stage, but hypothetically, if we're talking about someone who is willing to poison their ex to death.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information, medication and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Do we think that she would have much compunction in saying, oh, well, to hell with it, I'll serve it anyway? Like,
sorry, committing mass slaughter. I mean, can you think of another occasion where three people have died, and on the Crown case, she was aiming at killing five people in one go?
But
I mean, that's Martin Bryant kind of stuff. That's just that is slaughter on a mass scale.
Yeah, but if she had prepared, let's say the prosecution are correct, which has not been proved.
No.
But let's say she had prepared poisoned beef Wellington for that lunch.
Yes.
Is beef Wellington the little parcels?
It seems to be like a giant sausage roll.
Yeah, so they would have to have been individually prepared.
Oh, I think you make it as a roll and then you cut it up.
Oh, right.
I mean, I'm not.
I think I'm
not
thinking
a
cafe
Oliver.
Beef Wellington. Yeah, okay. I'm not sure.
Yep.
But so either way, if the ex had come, she was clearly prepared to serve it to everybody. So
sure.
she was going into that lunch, allegedly, with the intent of serving the poisoned beef Wellington to all of them. So if the ex isn't there, why suddenly does she change her mind? She was willing to poison them all in the first place.
Sure. I mean, I think if you've got to the stage where she has deliberately poisoned the beef Wellington with death cap mushrooms, you're 95-99% towards proving you're guilty. You know,
but that's right. But so just because he didn't come, and you're saying, well, why didn't she just not serve it? Well, she was willing to serve it to all of them, presumably willing. If the Crown case is correct, she would have presumably been willing to kill them all kill the ex.
Yeah.
And so it's not that much of a stretch to say, oh, well, she went ahead with the plan.
Yeah. Even though he wasn't there. It sounds to me like an utterly extraordinary plan that you would
kill. But that's because you're not murderous.
Sure, but I mean, as I say, you when is the last murder that you know that where somebody killed five people in one go? Because that's the plan.
In Australia?
Well, anywhere.
Oh, in America it happens all the time.
Okay, so mass shootings. All right. well, I mean, okay, Australia. Let's pick Australia.
Well,
five
I haven't
people in one go
studied
is poisonings. Just, well, it just is just staggering.
Well, it's staggering. It's abhorrent. It's horrific to consider. But we're talking about human experience, and we know that maybe not all at once, but there are plenty of people who've killed multiple people. So this is just getting it all in one hit. Like, it's not outside the realm of possibility.
No, you're right. It's not outside the realm of possibility, but is it beyond, could you be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt? I'm not sure you could. Oh, I mean, we don't know the evidence, so let's not prejudge it. But
you're saying
And can I just go back to your point about the mass shootings in America? Yeah, absolutely. But those people, when you look at them, they are troubled, you know, kids. And you hear all this stuff about, he was a goth at school and he hated everyone. He didn't talk to anyone. And then he turns up at the school with an M16 and thins out the crowd. I mean, you know, Erin Patterson seems to be a completely ordinary person who's a stay-at-home mum with two kids.
So did a lot of those. Like, it's not every mass shooter who has been recognised as a troubled person until they commit the crime. Like, it's only once they commit the mass shooting in some cases that there's hindsight and they say, oh, gosh, well, they did have this, this, and this. Like,
Yeah, we see the signs now. Yeah, that's there's lots of people walking around who have these sort of characteristics. They're antisocial. They're gothic. They, I don't know, hopefully don't torture animals or whatever. Yeah, and not all of them commit mass shootings.
Well, and not all mass shooters.
But then I think all mass shooters do evince those kind of antisocial behaviours.
I think that's a big generalisation. I think a lot of them do. But I think it would be wrong to say that is always a factor.
Well, I don't like absolute statements, so I would never say always. But
if I just come back to you having so much trouble with her willingness allegedly to murder five people, do you have any compunction in accepting that she may very well have intended to kill her ex?
Yeah, I've got lots of problems with that.
As a concept, like you're saying.
No, of course, you know, people, you know, have a motive to kill. I mean, lots of people have a motive to kill
their
ex.
That's right. But so
yeah.
I think it is horrendous to think of five people dying. But if you're willing to kill one person, it's not that much of a stretch to say chuck in the family as well.
Like, well, I think it probably is. I mean, often intimate partner violence is situational. So within the situation, the person is violent. Outside of that situation, they're not. And well, if you say, well, so I think it is if you say, well, my level of hatred towards my ex is such that I would be prepared to kill them. Again, if it's part of the situational violence, then outside of that, you're not actually a homicidal maniac who wants to kill everyone. You just have a deep-seated hatred for that particular person.
Yes, I accept that. But so just like you're saying, you're drawing some educated guesses here, just the fact that the ex and the family are willing to come over and have a lunch and you describe it as
convivial.
I mean, is that fact? Because for all we know, there were custody disputes going on. For all we know, the ex's parents might have been actively working to get greater access or custody. You know, I don't know, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but if you expand the potential circumstances to be that not only did she have conflict with the ex, or not only were there custody issues with the ex, but potentially with the extended family, then your situational argument for intimate partner violence, which can extend to general family violence, could very well have encapsulated the grandparents and the aunt and uncle.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we see that in domestic violence applications, that it's not uncommon for people to apply and then add their relatives as people who should also be covered by the restraining order. Because, yeah, so I completely accept that. But I think, and I'm not saying it's, you say, well, if I'm prepared to kill one, I'm prepared to kill five. That's possible. That's absolutely possible. But I just think it's not so possible that it's a given. I think, you know, people, you know, may well be in a situation where they're happy to kill one but not happy to kill anybody else. They just want that one person to.
But could you accept that there are circumstances where they would be willing to kill five?
I think there's circumstances when anybody, any of us, would kill five people if you put them in the right circumstances.
So then I think your disbelief that Erin Patterson may have continued on with her planned murder regardless of her ex-husband's presence is conceivable.
It is conceivable, but that's not the threshold. And this is an example, in my opinion, of problems that I see all the time, and it's the narrative fallacy. I was thinking of even doing a whole podcast on it. So, you know, humans like to identify particular facts and then weave a narrative around them. And you see this in miscarriage of justice cases all the time. I mean, the Susan Neil Fraser case is an excellent example. A few fragments of evidence are then weaved into this story about how Sue Neil Fraser goes out to the yacht and kills her husband and dumps her body. You know, similarly here, yeah, of course you can, with a few set, you know, a number of facts, then weave a narrative. But I always like to, and I've actually used it in jury addresses, talk about Occam's razor, about, you know, the simplest answer is most likely to be correct. So, to say, is it possible? Yeah, absolutely it's possible that she is a homicidal maniac who was prepared to commit mass slaughter on her ex and his relatives because she loathed them so much. That's absolutely possible. Is it likely? No, I don't think so. I think the most obvious, using Occam's razor, the most obvious answer is that this is just a lunch that's gone horribly wrong. Now, what the prosecution have done to support your position is they've also charged with the attempted murders from these three previous occasions.
Well, and I am pretty stuck on the fact she's the only one who didn't get sick.
Okay. Well, I mean, as I say, I don't know the details around that. Maybe it's been in the news. I haven't seen it. But so I think what the prosecution have done is they've charged the attempted murders as a way to shore up the idea of intention for the actual murders.
That's putting a lot of deceptive conduct.
It's not deceptive at all. Well, I'm sure they're completely upfront about that, and they want to run it all at one trial.
But
they can't fabricate. And, no, I'm not saying they're fabricating.
But so if there are circumstances from previous occasions that justify an attempted murder charge, why wouldn't that be part of the case? Like, obviously, it has to be part of the case.
Yeah, so they say it's justified. I don't know what the evidence is, so let's assume that it is justified. But it helps them, the three attempted murders, helps them prove intention on the actual murders, yeah?
And why is that bad? If she had...
Well, when you say it's bad, I mean, it's neither bad nor good. It's how our system works, and there are rules around, you know, running different charges in the same trial and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know if those arguments are going to be had or whether it's accepted, but I'm not saying that there's anything inappropriate. I'm saying as a matter of trial tactics or rhetoric, or persuasion, the fact that they've charged with the attempted murders is really integral, I think, in them proving the intention on the murders. To show that on previous occasions he has eaten her food and gotten sick, and then he was supposed to turn up to this lunch, didn't, and then all the other people, bar one.
I mean, it's not as though, by the sounds of it, it's not as though it was one occasion where he got sick after eating at her place.
It was three.
Yeah, so if there's three, I mean, that does, in fact, potentially show a pattern of behaviour which is very germane to what happened or did not happen on the day the parents and the aunt and the uncle came to lunch.
Well, it is, depending on how you look at it. So November 2021, May 2022, September 2022, he eats her food and gets sick.
How sick?
I don't know, sick enough
like
for it to be.
Oh,
I don't know, but sick enough for the prosecution to feel that.
And there must
it's an
have been records,
murder.
I would assume, if they are going to charge.
Well, there might not have been. Maybe he just said, I got sick and vomited for a few days and never went to the doctor. I don't know. But anyway, let's accept that he eats her food and he gets sick. Let's accept that. That's three occasions. You say, well, that indicates a pattern of behaviour. That is over the course of at least 12 months.
They're not married anymore. So how often are they eating together?
Well, I don't know when they separated, but, you know, in 2021 and 2022, she's cooking him meals.
But I assume it wouldn't be regular if they're no longer together.
Yeah, but this is my point. Let's assume they're together. She's cooking him meals every single night of his life. So 365 meals, he gets sick out of three of them. I mean, that's not a bad statistic in terms of cooking.
I have never
cooked a meal where someone got sick.
No, although I should say.
I would believe that about you.
No, well,
you're
I should say
diligent.
My 14-year-old would be jumping up and down because I did recently cook her a chicken schnitzel that was still pink. And
oh,
now
wow.
She's off chicken. So, but she didn't eat it and get sick.
No, but sure. But, I mean, I'm sure you're a great cook, but, I mean, are you an experimental cook? Maybe Erin Patterson's experimental. Maybe she likes to throw in different ingredients and see how things work and see what happens. I mean, I don't know, but to say, oh, he got sick on three occasions and just leave that as a statistic out there, I think that's problematic because it's like, well, let's put that in context of how often she cooked for him. Let's put it in
how
context of what kind of
cook
she was.
How many times have you cooked for someone and they've become sick?
Well, I hope none. Nobody's ever complained. But okay. I don't cook. I do cook a few times a week for anyway. But
three is a lot.
But, I mean, I know of a story where a woman cooked and made mayonnaise from scratch. The eggs were bad. It was at a function which was a fundraiser. A whole lot of people at the function got sick.
Oh, dear.
And an old woman died.
Ooh.
Yes.
Like this was someone you knew?
Well, it's a friend of a friend, yes. So
that's one occasion.
Sure, but I'm saying, I mean, I haven't made a study of how often people die from food poisoning. I suspect if we got a doctor, they'd say it happens more often than you think.
Mm.
And older people do tend to be more susceptible. I mean, these people are in their late 60s, early 70s who died.
But so, three times. Once is unfortunate. Two is concerning. Three is next level.
Okay, well, that kind of statistical analysis has been shown to be wrong in that recent case where the woman had four babies die of cot death Folbig.
Okay.
And they said you can't use that kind of reasoning. And any statistician would tell you you can't do that kind of reasoning.
All right, but let's just be very clear with Folbig that she was convicted and served 20 years. And
sure.
It was only when there was medical evidence that could be relied upon to show the genetic predisposition that she was exonerated. So that's a different circumstance.
I don't think it is. And the prosecutor's address to the jury in that case was exactly what you just said. It was one's tragic, two is even more tragic, three is absolutely curious, and four is she's definitely a murderer. Oh,
I am very adamant that she should never have been convicted. What I'm saying is it is a different circumstance to three separate meals that have resulted in serious illness, I would have to assume, if it's going to justify an attempted murder charge. You make that face, but there has to be.
It doesn't have to be serious illness. You can be attempted murder for shooting and missing somebody and they get no injury whatsoever.
But that's a lethal weapon.
Sure. Let's assume that there's some level of illness.
Correct. But that's different to the, you can't, that's apples and oranges. Folbig and this poisoning example, they're.
But you say, oh, because we then found out that there was medical evidence that showed that you couldn't do that kind of statistical reasoning.
So if we had medical evidence that said he was very prone to food poisoning, then I would be all on board.
Well, but what if I say, well, she cooks for him 365 days and out of three meals? I mean, that changes the statistic. And what if I say, well, she's an experimental cook. She likes to try different things.
So did she get sick on those three occasions?
Yeah, absolutely. All these things would be a factor.
And which, I can't help thinking, and I know I'm coming at it from a prosecution perspective, but if they are going to bring an attempted murder charge against her, then I would assume she did not get sick on those occasions. And so what is the likelihood on four occasions where people have gotten sick, the fourth so sick that they die, and she's at those meals and she amazingly does not have any side effects? That's got to be more than coincidence, Joe.
I think that's dangerous statistics. I think reasoning from statistics is always dangerous. I really do.
Reasoning from
statistics. So going, well, it's happened four times, so she's definitely guilty. I think
I'm not saying she's definitely guilty, but I'm saying I can understand A, why they've charged these offences, and B, why they would also charge the attempted murders from prior occasions and have that be part of the overall case.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's a legal basis for it. That's why they're doing it. But my point is from a rhetorical point of view, from trying to convince a jury, the attempted murders are essential, I think, to the murder because they support this intention to kill
the
GBH.
That's fair. If you'd been poisoned three times,
well, I'd be a bit concerned about eating their cooking again. But, I mean, as I say, maybe she's this experimental cook she loves, and he loves experimental food. He's like, let's try something new.
But you just said
he's
you
in
would
Thailand
be concerned.
Eating street food. I don't know. I mean, I don't do that. I'm super conservative before I eat. But
You can't say you would be concerned about eating her food again and then say, well, it doesn't really make sense to.
She hasn't invited me to dinner, but I'll consider that if she does. I don't know. So, anyway, it's certainly an interesting case for all those points of view. Now, I mentioned at the start I'd talk about some other cases. We probably don't have a lot of time, but I'll just mention a couple very briefly.
Okay.
So Florence Maybrick, this is a 19th century case, 1889. She's convicted of murdering her husband via arsenic poisoning. She married him when she was 18. He was 42. He was very wealthy. She was from a very wealthy family too. So, I mean, his brothers felt she was a gold digger and they sort of pressured or really pushed for her to be charged. He dies of arsenic poisoning. Now, he had been taking arsenic. He was a hypochondriac. He always thought he was sick. He was constantly taking medication to make him better. arsenic was one of the things he was taking. The case against her in a medical sense was very weak, because even the doses of arsenic they could sort of demonstrate that she might have been involved in giving him weren't lethal doses. Mm-hmm. And everybody accepted he was taking it himself. She's convicted. She's sentenced to, in 1889, she's sentenced to death.
Wow.
Commuted 2 weeks later. Apparently the judge's summing up was just off the dial bad.
Okay.
Because there had been infidelity in the marriage. He had mistresses. She had partners. The jury never heard that he had mistresses. The judge really went on about how she had been, you know, unfaithful in the marriage. And so it's commuted to life imprisonment. So it becomes a cause célèbre in England because she, the women's rights groups are up in arms about how, you know, patriarchal the legal system yeah. is and the double standards. But it's also used as a way to push for the creation of a court of appeal because there's no right of an appeal from a jury in 1889.
Uh-huh.
You're convicted by a jury, that's it. So that's one of the cases they used that said, well, there should be an appeal because the trial was so bad, you know, it should be corrected on appeal.
So who commuted the sentence?
The Home Secretary or something.
Oh,
you
right.
know, the,
okay.
It's in England, so I think the Home Secretary right. deals with all of that. So she does 15 years in jail. Apparently Queen Victoria was convinced she was guilty, and that's why she couldn't be let out of jail. When Queen Victoria dies, she's let out of jail.
Wow.
Goes back to the States, dies in poverty. So, but that is a case, and a case in those three elements that I talked about. So arsenic poisoning, they say he died of them. I'm not sure the standard of medical
proof. You know,
proof, but anyway. But how did was she involved in giving it to him? Well, he was taking it voluntarily, you know, and so that really affects both whether she administered a fatal dose, but also whether she had intention to kill. And again, they said intention to kill because she would benefit from his death by inheriting.
So was there evidence she had given him any doses?
Yeah, she would give him some medication from time to time, yeah. I mean, a bit like the Klaus von Bülow case, he was a hypochondriac, he was always taking medication.
Right.
And they got to a stage in their relationship where they really disliked each other, I think. It's quite a toxic relationship. But okay. And there was talk that they were going to divorce. And so that was all used as motive.
Right. So it was based on motive rather than
yeah.
intent per se.
Yeah. Mm. Then there's the other in the Australian case, which is fascinating. Emily Perry in 1978 and 79, she's charged with attempted murder of her husband, two counts, by arsenic poisoning. She's convicted. It goes all the way to the High Court. I don't even know how it got through the South Australian Court of Criminal Appeal. I mean, the case was so woeful. The High Court just absolutely tore it apart.
Mm.
Justice Murphy's decision is hilarious. He is just scathing about the expert evidence. So the guy, he gets sick from arsenic poisoning, but his hobby is to renovate old pianolas and pianos, which apparently often had, you know, rat poison in them, which is arsenic,
mm.
And also had lead in them. And so, and he'd been sick a number of times, and then he, you know, gets really sick, I think, and she's charged with attempted murders. But unbelievably, to support that charge, they accuse her and run evidence in front of the jury of how on three previous occasions she has poisoned people.
Other people.
They say she poisoned her second husband. This was her third marriage or something. He had died from arsenic poisoning. Never charged at the time. So this is, you know, 18 years earlier. Never charged, no
already
issues.
Already leaning towards those statistics.
Anyway. She collects his insurance policy. So they run this effectively murder trial for an 18-year-old murder, you know.
As part of the evidence.
Anyway, so then they say then there was another man who was, her brother. Killed her brother. They get more ridiculous as it goes. So the first one dies of arsenic poisoning. The second one dies of arsenic poisoning, but he's an alcoholic and he's depressive and he's been to mental institutions for depression. So there's every likelihood he could have committed suicide. She doesn't benefit from his death at all. The prosecution say she just wanted to get rid of her brother because he was, you know, difficult to deal with.
Problematic.
Mm. The third one is a de facto partner that she'd had for a number of years before she marries Mr. Perry.
And he also died of arsenic poisoning?
No, he dies of overdose of barbiturates, which he gave himself. But they said she convinced him to do it and she benefits from the life insurance policy.
Look,
So they run all that in front of a jury.
Okay.
Medical evidence is terrible and gets to the High Court. Justice Murphy just shakes his head. What's going on in South Australia? Throws it out. Acquitted.
Really?
But she's gone down. If you Google her name, Emily Perry, it comes up the black Australia's Black Widow.
But I 100%.
Oh my God.
Can understand. Like, that is a lot of this, a lot of arsenic activity around, in one woman's life.
Well, arsenic, I don't think it's used anymore. Maybe I'll go and ask my chemist if I buy some arsenic. But, you know, it's used, well, it was used as rat poison, but it was used, I don't know, medicinally.
Oh, I understand it was more people commonly
thought
it was an
available. Aphrodisiac at some point.
But, I mean, that, you know, wow, coincidence. Like, seriously. At some point, coincidence has to raise suspicions.
Maybe. I don't know. Anyway, the High Court certainly thought there was absolutely nothing.
Well, and all due respect to Justice Murphy, but the High Court aren't always right.
No, I think they're often wrong, particularly when they throw out appeals. But
maybe this judge just had something that, I don't know, he felt a particular way, but another judge may not have. Who knows?
It was a majority decision. He didn't sit on it alone. He writes a particularly scathing judgment.
I don't think that's an open and shut case by any means.
Wow. Poor old Emily Perry.
Wow.
And there was a more recent case, which I won't go into any detail, but because the woman has admitted to giving her partner antifreeze.
That is
shocking.
In tea,
I think, and he dies. She thought she was going to inherit money that he thought he was going to inherit, but it turns out he was victim of a scam and he wasn't inheriting anything.
Oh.
And so she killed him for the money and there was no money.
Life in prison?
I don't think she's been sentenced yet. It happened in November.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. What is wrong with people? Although listening to a lot of these, I mean, it brings to mind so many of the crime novels that I read. Mm. Like, this happens in
crime novels. In crime novels. It doesn't happen in real life. As you know, as a prosecutor, most crimes are very, very mundane. And that's what this whole, what I call the narrative, well, it's called the narrative fallacy, but I said this is an example of it in the law. You know, weaving together some very fascinating and interesting and exciting story from a series of facts, you know, and selling it to a jury whose only experience of criminal law is reading John Grisham novels.
How? Now you want to criticize a jury?
No, I'm criticizing the prosecutor for putting that together. That's what I'm criticizing.
Yes. Well, okay. I think that's a bit of a about face from an earlier conversation we've had about juries.
Great faith in the jury service, provided the trials run properly.
Yes, well, we will see.
Mm.
I think we'll have to follow up on Erin Patterson and see
we will.
What happens yes. there. Who is
innocent
correct?
Until proven guilty, so we
absolutely.
Should say all
and
of that.
And it's all allegedly.
Yes, all allegedly.
We're just talking theoretically.
Yes.
As an example that triggered it.
Yes. Lovely.
Very interesting. Thank you,
Joe. I'm glad
you
enjoyed it. Okay. Yeah, thanks. Good. Thanks, Lizzie.
I won't be coming to dinner.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.